The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Maureen Orth, founder of the Marina Orth School and Foundation, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
Maureen Orth is well known for being an award-winning journalist, a special correspondent for Vanity Fair, having profiled everyone from Vladimir Putin to Taylor Swift, and the author of two best-selling books. But something she is not as well known for, but of which she is equally, if not more, proud, is that of founder of the Marina Orth School in the nation of Colombia and of the Marina Orth Foundation. And here to share that wonderful story with us is Maureen Orth. Good evening, Maureen, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with Colombia. How did you first become involved and engage with that nation?
I became a Peace Corps volunteer right after graduating from Berkeley. I had just turned 21 years old, and I said I needed to go to an urban environment. I preferred Latin America, so that's how I got to Medellin.
Mm-hmm. And you've spent now over half a century there, visiting, living, working hand-in-hand with the people of Colombia. What are some of the general misconceptions we have in the United States about that nation?
Well, for one thing, I think that unfortunately Colombia is still very much defined in many people's mind as being a dangerous place known mostly for drugs, when in fact Pablo Escobar, the great narco, was killed in 1993. And the business has shifted since then much more towards Mexico. And Colombia, particularly Medellin, Bogota, the big cities, it's the second most biodiverse nation in the world. It's the size of Texas and California put together. It has 50 million people. The average age is 29. The cities themselves are quite dynamic. Medellin won the title in 2016 by the Wall Street Journal as being the most dynamic city in the world, and it beat out New York and Tel Aviv.
Pretty impressive, yeah. Yeah. And they're by and large a very happy population.
Well, that's the interesting part of it. Colombia is a very unequal country. Mm-hmm. It's the second most unequal country in Latin America after Honduras. And it's gone through this terrible armed insurrection with the FARC that only concluded at the end of 2016, the armed revolutionaries. And they gave rise to paramilitary who were equally cruel. And many, 250,000 deaths over a 50-year period and 8 million displaced people. So these are really horrific, terrible statistics, and there was a tremendous amount of suffering. But with all that, every time you have these who's the happiest people on the planet survey, Colombia always scores in the top three, yeah, practically. So they love music, they love dancing, they've got just a lot of joie de vivre.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're down there as a Peace Corps volunteer. It's mm-hmm. in the mid-1960s,
mm-hmm.
and you are asked to help build a school. Now, here you are, Peace Corps volunteer. You're in your 20s. Why in the world would they have gone to you to say, help us build a school?
Because I was living in a very poor barrio on the outskirts of town, and my job was urban community development. Mm. And so I think they knew about the Peace Corps, and they thought maybe there would be people there who, you know, they could help because they weren't going to necessarily get any access. And so maybe let's just put the gringa out there and see if she can. So this very dramatic posse of men on horseback came knocking on my door one Sunday, and they had a horse for me, and we just rode straight up into the mountains above my poor barrio, and it was a small community, agricultural community, and they wanted a school very badly, so they asked me if I would help them build the school, and I said sure. And we got the coffee growers to give us the bricks and mortar, and the city had to sort of pave a road so the trucks could come in to, you know, deliver the building materials. And that's how we started. And after about a year, we had a two-room school for 35 children. And I was so astonished, but they named the school Escuela Marina Orth because they could never pronounce Maureen, so I became Marina. So
and
that
I'm trying to resist calling you Maureen. I haven't read so much about it. It's hard for me to now say Maureen. So you did that, and the school grew. But there was a period there during those drug wars that you were talking about that you really had a hard time going back to Medellin.
Yes, absolutely. It was way too dangerous to go. So between 1981 and 2004, I was only there twice. I just went back in 1995 and then back in 2004.
Was the school able to function with all this violence around them?
It was, and I was very gratified because when I went back for the first time in 14 years, in 1995, I was feted with poetry and dances and a serenade and lunch and mass and all these different things. And it was interesting because Escobar had been killed in 93, so that meant that most of the violence around there had subsided, although there was still lots of paramilitary and weird stuff going on. But nobody ever touched the school. It had enough respect by all sides that was kind of off limits.
Sort of a zone of peace?
A zone of peace, yes.
Well, when you returned again, which was in 2004, mm-hmm. the Secretary of Education asked to meet with you.
Mm-hmm.
What was his concerns? What did you want to talk to you about?
Well, I had no idea why I was being summoned, but when I went back the second time, I got the same homage, kind of, and he got wind of it, and so he called me into his office, and he was the Secretary of Education of a newly elected reform mayor. And he said, Marina, these kids have no chance to compete in the 21st century unless they have English and technology. Will you please help us make your school the first public bilingual school?
Mm-hmm.
And I said yes, and that therein begins the tale.
Yeah. Well, what was the importance of English in his mind, and why have you made this the first bilingual school?
Because English is really the lingua franca. I mean, English is the absolute international language, particularly with regard to technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really the statistics. If somebody can learn English, their chances, I think they earn immediately, they can earn about 30% more than they would ordinarily. And
mm-hmm.
also, if you've got a young country like Medellin, you really, and we're in the middle of a technology revolution, you just really have to have people who are prepared to access knowledge in the main language in which you access it is English.
Mm-hmm. And technology is one of your pillars. What do you do for these students around technology?
Well, we introduced one laptop per child, which is these little green and white, they look like a toy practically,
yep.
computers to kids down there. And we had the very first rural Wi-Fi village and the very first rural families on Facebook. But these are wonderful little computers that were developed by the MIT Media Lab, and they're practically indestructible. They're sort of military grade in terms of sustainability. And so we advocate the use of technology in the classroom. And when we started, I mean, the teachers, you know, didn't know how to use email or anything like that. And so we try to, what we do really is try to do two things at once almost all the time. and so while we're teaching English, we're also teaching technology. And these little computers, for example, had no provision for maintenance or repair. So, well, we just started teaching the kids how to take them apart and put them back together. They have 34 screws, so we teach that in the third grade. And the kids who have the most facility then become the kids who belong to our monitors club, and they take over the maintenance function.
So you're really making them quite self-reliant.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
And then they can also bring them home, and you can't steal them because they're all on a single switch. And so if they platform, so if they get stolen or anything like that, then they're useless because we just turn it off. But the very, very few have ever been stolen. I mean, we're in 21 different schools now. We've distributed over 7,000 computers, and I could count on one hand the numbers that have ever been taken away.
Mm-hmm. And how many students are you serving on an annual basis?
Oh, it fluctuates, but it's somewhere I'd say it's somewhere around between 3,500 and 4,500.
Wow,
somewhere.
You've really grown.
Yeah.
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 And one of the most impressive things that I saw around technology was this robotics competition.
Yes.
That your kids were involved with. Tell us about that.
Well, this is so exciting because in some of our schools, we start teaching robotics at kindergarten. And our kids, we could not possibly afford expensive Legos kits. So we encourage the kids to do these projects using old recycled plastic bottles and cardboard and bits of wire and things like that. And so they become, having used the computers in the school and putting them, taking them apart, putting them together, and then getting interested in robotics, they become very comfortable with technology. This past May, we sent two teams to an international robotics competition in Albuquerque called Robo Rave. And one of the teams, and we had to do GoFundMe, et cetera, to get them there. But anyway, one of the teams was our all-girl team called the Little Engineers. And I am very proud to say that the Little Engineers in the middle school category beat the boys from Japan, China, Mexico, India, and the United States and won the gold.
Wow, congratulations. So you're really competitive on a world stage.
Well, we were very excited. We didn't realize that we could compete on the world stage. We just thought Japan had it in the bag. But then the second day we realized, oh, my God, we don't have to compete for second place. We can compete for first place.
There you go. Well, that's quite a feather in the cap of the school.
Thank you.
And, you know, the last fundamental pillar you have is around leadership. Speak to that.
Well, that's very important, particularly when you come in a very class-based society like Columbia, particularly with a lot of kids who are underserved kids. They're very humble or they're very shy and timid. So what you really want to do is I think that given how quickly technology is changing and advancing, people have to know how to work in teams. And they also have to learn how to express themselves because soft skills are becoming more and more important because people have to change jobs so much. You know, I found out that kids who are just starting primary school now, 65% of those kids, we don't even know what their jobs are going to be because they haven't been invented yet.
That's right.
So we emphasize public speaking, presenting yourself, being able to take charge and working with your team and et cetera. So that's what we consider leadership and also discipline, very, very important. We do a lot of teacher training, classroom management, and being able to kind of stand up for yourself and also be able to express yourself. And I have my own rule is the EEP rule, which is energy, enthusiasm, empathy, polite, prepared, persistent.
Okay. So, I'll remember that.
Empathy, very important.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one thing I sometimes see is that young people don't realize that you can actually talk on a phone.
To a human voice.
To a voice. And speak to someone instead of texting them. It actually does work that way. Well, with all this work you do with young people, you also have a program that is called SparkTech. You do that in partnership with Microsoft. Now, who is that directed towards?
That's directed toward the youth who neither work nor study, the kind of hardcore dropouts. We recruit them from some of the most violent, dangerous parts of the city because we're just trying to show them. We teach them how to make an app. We teach them various computer skills. There's a deficit, for example, in Medellin of 90,000 programmers right now. So you really want to prepare people for something where they can go get a real job. And a number, we've trained about 500 of these kids so far. And a lot of them are women, and so a lot of them have gone back to school, which is great. So again, that's something where, and we work in the juvenile detention center with young women, and making them feel good about themselves, that they understand how to do something that's worth something.
And well-paying jobs, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Do you feel that Central and South America is often overlooked by the development community or at least by the press? You know, I have a lot of people on this show, and we're talking about these kinds of efforts, but it always seems like we're talking about Southeast Asia or Sub-Saharan Africa or China and never hardly about South, Central, and Latin America. How do you how have you experienced that?
Oh, it's so true. I was told a few years ago by somebody in the Inter-American Development Bank that only 10% of international corporate giving goes to Latin America, and of that 10%, 3% goes to education, and probably most of it maybe goes to Brazil or Mexico. I mean, it's just absurd because they have our time. There are time zones, a lot of our values. It's strange to me why Latin America is so overlooked, because it's very dynamic and it has a young population that's growing. And for example, Colombia fought with us in Korea. Mm-hmm. You couldn't have people that love America more.
Right. We're not quite as reciprocal, I think, the other way.
Not really. Except, yes, we consume their drugs and don't take responsibility for it.
Well, you did a fascinating piece in the September issue of Vanity Fair on one of the few women FARC commanders known simply as Corina. First of all, well, tell us about Corina.
Well, Corina was a very, very feared the armed revolutionary forces of Colombia, the FARC. She was a very, very feared comandante, one of the few real female leaders on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And she terrorized communities. And there were horrendous stories that she says that the more the army couldn't catch her, the more cruel she became in terms of her reputation. But there was even a story that she played soccer with the decapitated heads of her victims, but she strongly denies that. In any case, she was she had $1 million price on her head, and she was not caught for 24 years. She finally turned herself in because a lover betrayed her. But the reason I was so interested in her is because one day a former politician took me to the back of this little rural school outside of town, El Carmen de Viboral, near Medellin. And he said to me, he goes, "See that path?" And there was just this mountain right in front of us. And he said, "See that path? That path belonged to Corina." Hmm. And she terrorized us for 15 years. And he said, "I want you to come here because I went to your school." And he said, "Nobody ever touched it because you created a zone of peace. Now I want you to come here and create another zone of peace." And I said, "Okay."
That's pretty inspiring.
It was about the best compliment I ever got in my life.
Yeah. And one thing about the FARC, they were always maintained that they treated each gender equally.
Correct.
And that was true to a degree, but it certainly wasn't the case when it came to sex. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in terms of women being trained to carry arms and heavy loads and who did the cooking and the washing, there was, and they were Marxist, that was considered equal. Mm-hmm. However, with regard to sex, if a man had many partners, he was considered lucky. But if a woman had two or more, she was considered relajada, relaxed, or a loose, promiscuous woman. And she could be easily condemned in a war council and taken out and shot for that. Mm-hmm. And forced abortion was a policy because you could not be a mother and be a soldier. And they passed out these pills to force abortions, or they had people. It was just, there's just so many horrendous stories about what happened to women. And there was such machismo in the rural Colombian society and in a lot in Latin America as a whole, that the whole secretariat of the FARC were male, and nobody ever questioned that. Nobody ever questioned their orders to do those kinds of things.
Well, so Corina would be one among those people who carried those out.
And when Corina was finally brought in and she went into jail and she realized the headlines were huge, and then she was considered evil incarnate, and she realized how much she was hated and how much evil. And she had this very dramatic jail conversion, and she's become an evangelical Christian. And it took her a really long time sitting there in solitary, thinking very clearly and reading the Bible and things like that about what she had done. And she came to realize how wrong it was. But she was recruited at age 16 and was sort of brainwashed and never knew a different sort of reality.
Well, it's a fascinating story. So, Maureen, how is all this supported? What is your business model? What are your sources of revenue? Who are your investors?
Well, we do public-private partnerships, and so we're incorporated as a 501c3. MarinaOrthFoundation.org is a 501c3 in the United States. We also have a nonprofit, Marina Orth Foundation, in Colombia, and so I basically have private donations in both countries and private sponsors in both countries. And corporate entities and some Colombian government. But I have to do a lot of fundraising. So if anybody wants to go to funda.org, follow us on Facebook or Instagram or go to our website. I'd love it.
Yeah. And you may have to do more fundraising because you have some very ambitious plans between now and 2022. What are you striving to achieve?
I would like to be able to. I think that our SparkTIC program, for example, is really scalable, particularly with regard to former combatants from the war or any kind of group of kids who are older or people who are just untrained and who can be trained to have technical skills and learn a sustainable business model. So I'd like to try to launch some kind of business that we could do or scale that. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you're not a charity, really. You're a social enterprise.
Oh, I want to say that. That's a very important thing. We do not do charity, okay? Mm-hmm. We are doing economic development. We are contributing to the GDP of Colombia, but we're also, I mean, seriously, we're training the future labor force. I don't consider this any kind of a charity organization at all.
Yeah, not at all. Well, doing what you've done and doing it well is not an easy undertaking. What has been the biggest challenge for you in trying to get this right?
Oh, gosh, there are so many challenges. First of all, when we first started out, Medellin is the financial center of the country, but it's also a very closed society. They all know each other. And even if you were there as a Peace Corps volunteer at age 21, and also there's a lot of mistrust that's been built up over the years of all the strife and et cetera. So to kind of get people to believe to work together, that's a big challenge. Working with the public school system is a huge challenge because teachers are underpaid and undertrained. And so I would say those are two of my largest challenges. Just working, it's not the kids so much, it's the adults. And then we also have a very horizontal model, and most of the people working in the foundation are young kids themselves. About average age is about 26. And we work very horizontally. So to get older, more seasoned, specialized people to come in and work, they're used to such a hierarchical, rigid, more rigid model that we're more like a startup.
Yeah, yeah. Let me close with this, Maureen. You know better than most of us the power of stories. Share with us one or two of the thousands of children who have come through your school and the impact that school has had on their lives.
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that we have several of the graduates of the Marina Orth School are now working for the foundation. Our director of scholarships, for example, we send kids on to the university, is a young woman who came from a displaced family and was forced to come live at near the Marina Orth School. She defines herself as a feminist and environmentalist, and And then we have another young woman who's working her way through, and she's teaching English for us. But I'm most proud that they've decided to come back and work at the foundation and contribute because they're grateful for, and they want to pass on our model. But there's one young man who's now in his third year of law school, studying international human rights. And he is the president of the Philosophy Club. He's fluent in English, and he was mentored by this other wonderful older Peace Corps couple in Chicago who came down to volunteer one cold winter and brought him to Chicago for one summer. So now he's been an intern on Capitol Hill in Washington, and he was my researcher for the Carina story, and he was flawless. He was just as thorough and professional as any Vanity Fair researcher I've had. Marlon, he's great.
Well, this is a remarkable story. Maureen Orth, the founder of the Marina Orth School and Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Now, tell us a little bit more about that website and how people can help if they should be so inclined.
Yes, it's marinaorth.org, MARINAORTH. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram and also on the web. And I would love you to donate. And if you want to come down and visit, you want to volunteer, we have volunteers for a year or 6 months. And they help us in after school clubs, particularly with English. And they also help teach. And we're starting a new program on the Pacific Coast where there's a lot of surfing and also a tremendous amount of poverty. And so, we'd love volunteers, too.
Sounds like a worthwhile way to spend your time. Thanks, Maureen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.